What follows is a slightly edited audio version of the most recent live Limitless group meetup, in which we discussed life force and purpose and the creation of hell and the accessing of heaven, things like that. It's interesting to kind of observe, like, as I say, there's no pressure here because it doesn't matter if people sing or not, but it's interesting that it does create as much pressure as it does. I think that's worth itself, just putting the attention on. Technically, it's called performance anxiety and or stage fright. I like the first one better because it overlaps nicely with sex, and the only reason, I mean, I did start with that was because it means that it makes it harder to lead with concepts or thought structures or clusters that we all know that we carry around and polish and rearrange, and like Lego sets, we're constantly taking apart and building our thought edifices that our little identities live in. And there's always going to be a tendency to just start building those as soon as we open it up to talking or sharing. I was just checking my email, because I wondered what happened with Susie. It's possible that she panicked. I hope not. I'm hoping it's just a technical thing. So, anyone, I mean, before your chat, your window of opportunity is about to close, Jeff and Ched, so, just so you know, just in case you feel like this might be, a regret that will haunt you into eternity. Okay, so, right, so what does all this have to do with leaving hell and accessing heaven? Has to do with the life force and the purpose that the life force inspires us with, which I've been thinking about because that was the subject matter of yesterday's Oshana event. And well, as I say, I was listening to the Flying Pickets, if any of you know that band from the 80s. They had one hit when they covered a song. They do covers, and they don't use instruments, they just all use voices. But they do a good job of, like, you might not even notice they don't do instruments because it's such a full sound between them. And they did a cover of Road to Nowhere, which is how I discovered them or rediscovered them yesterday. I was thinking about how that was kind of a metaphor for this thing about heaven, like what is heaven and what is hell? That we could say that hell is disconnection. Dostoevsky had a definition of it, if we're going to be momentarily literary, which is the suffering that comes from an incapacity to love. We could say that from a lack of connection and inability to connect. That's self-quarantining, that self-inflicted isolation is the nature of hell, in quotes. And then, so heaven, by that definition, is, you know, the full development of our capacity to love and full connection, interconnectivity between souls. And that, with the Flying Pickets, it seemed like that was an example of that, of different souls literally harmonizing together, their voices working together to create a whole concerto of sound. and a feeling. And anyone who's been in a band, I don't know if anyone has here, I haven't, so I'm actually projecting and assuming, but it's actually the last chapter of Maps of Hell is about this. So I use David Byrne as my one positive example from culture to show that culture's not all bad. What happens when a group of individuals get together and find ways to resonate with one another so that they harmonize and resonate and amplify one another's signal and merge into a shared field of consciousness? Seems to me that that's similar if we think of human beings as components in a larger body called humanity, which, as Chad and I were discussing, may not involve 7.5 billion. When I say humanity, I don't know what I mean by that in physical terms, but let's just say that there is a collective humanity that we're part of. Sorry, we lost Susie there. I didn't think I was being too terrifying. Right, so the body of humanity, it seems that there could be a correlation there. We see with our own bodies that parts are asleep, some parts are stiff or blocked or not functioning, they're not conscious, consciousness has not gone into all the parts of the body, and that is to do with them not all being connected. I mean, all the different parts aren't connecting and working together. And this correlates in turn with the life force. Is the life force fully landed in the body? Have we entered into our purpose? We could think of the life force as conscious purpose, or purpose as the way that the life force is experienced by us. Think of it various different ways. Jeff has gone off into nirvana on that thought. So I think that was it really, as far as an intro, to provide a context, for without necessarily raising the conceptual bar too high in terms of what we're here to do or what can happen in our lives, but at the same time, and this would be true of a band that's jamming. Remember, Talking Heads did this for Naive Melody. They swapped instruments so that they would all be pushing themselves to their limit, and at the same time, they'd have to improvise. They'd have to be amateurish. They would be amateurs, and that would test them to their limits. But it also would allow for something else to come through. Oh good, Susie's come back. So they wouldn't be able to fall back on their professionalism. They'd have to trust in the force, not that force, the life force, to move them. Obviously, they were super genius musicians, so whatever. But we all have our equivalent of that. Welcome back, Susie. I was worried that we'd chased you off by putting too much pressure. So the singing bit is just like, well, imagine we're here together and we actually are here together to make a song. Then who you are and who you think you are and all your life story and your history and what's got all that's irrelevant. We just can you hold a note? Can you carry a tune? Can you think of a line? It frees all that stuff up. Now it does create all this other pressure. Oh my God, am I going to be able to do it? Which I think is really code for, am I going to expose myself as something I'm not? Or, how can I present myself if I can't just bring me? If you see what I mean. Whereas if I ask, okay, Mari, Ched, Jeff, Susie, Hugo, what's going on for you? Tell me what's going on, how you feeling? Then you can just come right in with, oh, I remember how to do this. I'm Chedomir, and I live in Serbia, not Croatia, and I've got three generations of women around me. Sorry, I'm giving away all the secrets here. They're not secrets, but yeah. Anyway, I could do that with all of you a bit. I know a bit, but obviously you've got the full story. You've got a massive, a whole Russian library to refer to there of data that you can just draw on at will. It's your own matrix that you've been downloading your whole life, and it's telling you who you are, and then you regurgitate that. So, I mean, that's not really much help to anyone, is it? I mean, it's obviously it's useful if you get stopped by the cops, but in our current arrangement or setup, we have an aspiration which is to, well, prison break is the analogy that Dave's been using recently. He used it on me one time. He even tried to get me to watch Prison Break, terrible American TV show. But I won't get digressed by that. The movie critic in me will take over, and it wouldn't be pretty. But yeah, the prison break, he's been using that analogy that we came here to help others break out of the prison, and then we forgot, and then we just thought, well, actually, I'm going to try and get a better cell and maybe get some privileges, and maybe we can talk to the cook and get some better food, and I want more channels on my TV. We're doing all this stuff basically to make it as comfortable as possible in the prison rather than actually completing our purpose, which is to break a few souls out, including ourselves at this point. And that's the accessing heaven bit, which is synonymous with leaving hell. There's an interesting whatever there is, like, well, is there a difference between leaving hell and accessing heaven? I don't think there is. I think they're essentially the same thing. Just see, depends on which side of the equation we're on. Are we still looking at the map, or are we looking up from the map at what is, what's happening? So anyway, all of this speaks to the necessity of a little bit of discomfort, as in sing me a line from a song, whatever it might be. As I say, it kind of makes it, but there's a area there to play within is how much do we volunteer to fall flat on our faces and try things that we don't feel comfortable trying, and how much do we want to be guided and pushed into doing it so we can blame, whoever's making us make an ass of ourselves. And that dovetails with Susie's question, which is probably for a podcast, but it might come up today as well. It was Susie's question on a previous meeting, but there are still elements to it, I think, that she wants to explore. What are the benefits, if any, of having some sort of teacher or leader or guide, to, I would say, to give us permission to express parts of ourselves that we are afraid to express. Now, part of that is making it feel safe, letting us know it's safe to do it. But another part, and that's got to be no pressure, no judgment, but another part is making it sufficiently uncomfortable that we actually feel pushed to do so, to do it, to express, to override the fear factor. This came up a little bit with on an email exchange that Ched was on today, where Ched was saying that he might be okay staying in hell a bit longer if it meant a few souls got to go to heaven. Paraphrasing a little bit there, but. And I half joked, well, maybe Ched, maybe you just want to stay in hell a bit longer. And so it's a half joke, because I think, I mean, we are all pretty comfortable, that's the point, in hell. What an irony. Pretty transcendental irony, isn't it? When you get comfortable in hell, what happens? Well, a number of things. You could say it's less hellish, so that's a positive. There is an element of acceptance which helps us to change. But the other thing that can happen is we just don't want to leave, obviously, and we end up becoming one of the guards, one of the demons. That's very dark. I don't necessarily want to get that dark, but on the other hand, I like to be realistic, as you know, realistically pessimistic. So yeah, all of this is what is all of this? It's like, I suppose I'm calling, or something in me is calling to something in you, but also something in me is responding to a call in you. So we're signaling like a prison walls, we're tapping on the prison walls. Anyone there? Tap, 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 tap. And I'm listening to hear the tap. Okay, is that a real tap or is that just pipes that are clicking from heat? Whatever. Is there someone actually in there trying to learn the, trying to, develop a code that we actually know that we're getting through? And so I'm trying now to translate the life force into words for a long enough period that when you start signaling back, blah 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 blah, it's the life force that's coming through and not the erector set of mechanic. I'm just one of the prisoners here. I'm just trying to get extra mashed potato, mate. Don't bother me with this. We talk about escape, we just get in trouble. Just make things worse. Which, I mean, part of that is legitimate. So if you're going to make a prison break, you definitely want to keep a low profile, make it look like you're a happy prisoner and no trouble here. And we will do that even to ourselves, as in, if there's part of us that is starting to emerge, arise, awaken. It knows that there's a guardian installed within us, a defense system, a saboteur that will prevent that. So then that rising life force has to also keep a low profile, not let us notice, not let our conscious minds notice it. Dave said this to me once when I was talking about being depressed, even though I could feel stuff was happening. He used that analogy where you have to keep a lot of this secret from yourself. And so that brings to mind, Chad's doing a lot with his head there. I was just about to mention him. Well, Dave's brought up this thing about purpose. What's your purpose recently? And he's been browbeating us, as he does sometimes, from time to time, being the stern father guy. And he's refusing to accept people's claim when they say they don't know what their purpose is. And Chad got particular focus in on that regard. And I think I know why. Maybe we'll get into that or not. Maybe Chad knows why. Chad probably does know why, but he might not admit it. So that overlaps as well. I don't know what I'm here for. No, I'm just here to, make my bunk bed and sell cigarettes in the yard, kind of thing. Obviously, we've got to have good cover. I mean, in order to have good cover, we've got to believe it a little bit. So there's a certain amount of strategic amnesia. But then, at a certain point, it's not strategic. It's just convenient. Oh yeah, I can just carry on watching Netflix and eating Kettle Crisp for a few more decades because, I got all the time in the world. Dave's actually started mentioning crisps a lot recently, and I'm sure that's because I finally gave them up. So he thinks he can take off the kid gloves now, really let us have it. So anyway, I mean, maybe that's all over the place. There's a few variables here, which I could try to sum up. But they really have to do with, how we're using our life force. And there's really two ways to use the life force. One is to feed hell, to feed the system that is hell, and the other is to create heaven. to discover slash create heaven. Obviously, that's very poetic. Not, don't want you to over literalize it. It might even be a bit meaningless in a sense to reduce it to such simple terms, but while at the same time so grandiose. But I suspect that everybody here has a feeling of what I mean by that, and how and why, because it relates to the life force, it is the outcome of that, of our lives, collectively and individually, is determined, or is influenced anyway, by every single, Susie's playing with a Harvey bunny there. It's very symbolic, the bunny. It's like the Pooka from Harvey, or Invisible Ally. It's a movie reference, maybe you don't get it. Every little thing we do with our life force, it's playing with a bunny, or scratching his foot, as Jeff just did. Ted moving his head around. All these little things we do influence the outcome. Will they take us one step closer to heaven? Or they don't? So that's the kind of unified theme, I think, that I've been bouncing around today, and the correlation there between how we got stuck on this again last time as well, not how we manage our life force, but how we express our life force, how we follow our life force, and how we discover our life force, how that's really most essential or most experiential with each other collectively. As in, I mean, and this was something of a breakthrough statement from Dave yesterday, I feel, was that he, at a certain point, he said, you know, nobody is fully expressing their life force. And it was clear to me, the way he was saying the nobody, that he was including himself in that. And then he explained it by saying that the extent to which we can our life force can become fully conscious, incarnate and expressed or engaged, depends on others. Because as we all know, you know, people bring out the best in us and they bring out the worst, or they bring out a mix of both, or they just don't bring out anything at all. I'm going to drink some water, see what happens after that.
still remembers a thing. If they still go by, just like that. Maybe I could have treated you better. Maybe it wouldn't have changed a thing. But if you ever look me up, try and think of me as a dream. But something must have happened, and I'm not sure what it was. I know that something must have happened. I can't feel it washed in my blood.
Jeff.
I'll just say that in these kind of group meetups, I notice that my brain starts going all over the place, and like it's so different than having just like a linear conversation. So when I'm listening to you talk, like I just get impressions as you're saying things, you know, or like almost like reminders, and I'll jot it down or whatever. But you know, it's like I'm not sure, like it's like if there's a question being posed, or if it's just kind of like just put something out there, you know, type of thing. So it seems like you're just kind of asking for just to expand on what you're touching on. Is that
possibly I don't know what I'm asking for. I think if I was, I mean, I can ask you to sing a song, obviously, and then we both know, right? But that's symbolic, as in that's like, you know what I mean? That's an exercise. But I'm asking for people to express themselves and see what comes out. Really.
That's fine, and that's like that's where I was heading on mm-hmm. kind of on my own, anyways. One of the things I was getting when you were talking about the concept of heaven and hell, or leaving hell and entering heaven, was just this like impression of like about the most dualistic thing you could possibly have, you know, like the concept of heaven and the concept of hell, and how I don't think I could fully imagine or really even come close to imagining like experiencing either one. But I get these little glimpses, like right before this meetup started, I had this thought that for me right now or lately, hell is other people's opinions, or more specifically, you know, my inability to accept them, or my reaction to them. And then that brought me to the idea that heaven would be to have no preferences, at least like heaven on earth type of thing, you know, meaning just kind of like, I don't know if to be okay with everything is the right way to say it, but I have a hard time being more specific than that, but it just seems like every time I'm suffering, or I feel like I'm in hell, it's because somehow the world is not meeting my requirements. So and it doesn't seem like changing those requirements works, because they're never going to be met. So it almost seems like, how do I get rid of them completely? And I'm not saying that it's possible, or maybe that it's even desirable, but it's just been really profound lately with everything that's going on. And so maybe it's, you know, it's definitely showing me something. So that's, I don't know, something that I just wanted to bring up. And then also the concept that hell is very customized, like for each person. Because when you were talking about it, I was wondering, like, you know, what if you had a definition that you could throw out there, you know, and you kind of did by saying what how the life force expresses itself, or whether it adds, I forget your exact words, whether it adds to it or detracts from it. But I don't know. Those were just some thoughts. Also, I just kind of felt the need to talk, because since I didn't sing, I started having this, you know, this kind of anxiety building in me a little bit, just to participate on some level. So got that out of the way.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, I think that last point to me speaks most about the difference between heaven and hell. Is, you know, am I blocked or am I flowing? Am I trapped or am I free? And that would be the life force speaking. So anyway, I just wanted to have that as a response. 10 minutes, looking super relaxed there. Anyone else wanted to articulate?
I'll say something.
Okay.
Sorry, I disappeared. I've been having computer problems, so it's working for now. And I missed the singing, so that's a shame. But I won't offer to sing now. But just like when you were saying, Jason, about knocking on the wall, tapping on the prison wall, is there anyone there? And I feel like, yes, I'm here now. I'm on the other side, and I'm ready to start breaking out now, I think. I'm sort of feeling the flow is happening a lot in me. It's been very gradual, and it still comes and goes. And the thing that I'm working on the most is the integration of my autism, which is, feels like kind of the final piece for me. And situations like this, I find very kind of overstimulating. So I have to move and kind of look away from the screen a bit. So that is something that I'm very aware of what it is, and I know what it is, and I know how to, but it does bring on profound kind of sensory internal sort of overexcitation and different kind of situations. But it's okay, I can manage, but I do kind of feel at an excitement and a kind of a ready to emerge sort of vibe. That's what I'll say.
Thanks, Susie. That intense will syndrome is a phrase that I used recently. I noticed you responded to it, or you noticed it. I mean, that's my favorite, my preferred hypothesis of autism. I'm sure there are many things being called autism, right? And it's not just one thing. But anyway, I think what Susie's talking about, and I don't know if I'll be able to put all this together, but I'm sure that we're all feeling it, right? Right now, but generally in life, we're all always feeling it. I've got this thing, highly sensitive people now. I don't really like that. I think that's for Hollywood, you know, wannabes. But it occurred to me that if we're overstimulated, if we find that we're receiving more information, more perceptual experience than we can assimilate or process, then heaven could become hell very quickly. That chaos and that disorganization would lead to a panic and possibly an internal meltdown or shutdown. so that occurred to me, that this what Jeff was bringing up, the polarity of in heaven and hell may not be a polarity at all. I mean, I said on the recent blog post that there is no hell. There's just the map of heaven has created hell, if you like, the map of our experience, our attempt to create a filter to prevent ourselves from being overwhelmed by existence has turned into this prison over time. So something that was meant to protect us and help us to manage existence has ended up trapping us. Anyway, but also I just wanted to point out to people that what Susie's describing here, maybe I don't need to point it out, but it's probably not really that different from what everybody here is experiencing to different degrees. Jeff said, well, he found it kind of overwhelming when I'm talking. He's getting all these different impressions. He has to take notes. Jeremy has to do a lot of physical movements and keep stretching his neck and so on. Like there's, and I also, like trying to manage what's going on here, even in terms of cognitively, is overwhelming. And it's okay that it is. Of course, when it comes to articulate, then we might feel intimidated, like, oh, I can't possibly articulate any of this. But of course, we don't have to articulate any of it, or we don't have to articulate all of it, and we don't have to articulate any particular part of it. It's not, I mean, there's no way that we, this is the point about mapping hell again, there's no way that we can map all of existence. So when we start to try or start to think that that's something we're supposed to be doing, then we're just creating a constant reason to be anxious, reason to panic. Not to say that obviously we're not consciously doing this, but that's what happens. This is feeling of being constantly just on the edge of panic, which I can certainly relate to. I think people have different ways of managing that. Go back to gallery view. And some people manage it by being super calm and super still, but they're still managing it. The main thing we do, really, is we just try to control our expression. We monitor it, we police it, we regulate it in such a way that nothing leaks out. Of course, things are constantly leaking, so we're fooling ourselves. And actually, by doing that, we're more likely to be leaking. Essentially, because we're suppressing a lot of the more intense feelings, and so they have to come out. They'll come out our ears and our asshole if they don't come out our mouths. So again, that's why the singing thing is like, well, what can people do where they just have to push past that inhibition? And I think singing is fine, but it's a bit of a gimmick in a way, and obviously it's a game-like thing. We could also do free associating. That's always interesting and often fun. But then there's also simply speaking and having an experience of speaking that's new. As in finding a different voice or finding one's voice little by little, finding the true voice that comes from those deeper parts of ourselves that consciousness hasn't made it to yet. Because like when you sing, you have to learn to hit notes that aren't comfortable. Like Hugo, he didn't want to go high. We could say there's a similar phenomena in terms of expressing and articulating our experience, including our emotions, but not only, that there are notes that we don't know how to hit. Some people can't express anger, some people can't express love, some people can't express joy. You're very dark there, Mari, in the dark. symbolic enough. Hiding in the darkness. So, I mean, what's the context here? It's expressing to find out what you have to express. That's why, I mean, I was almost wanted to question Jeff a bit with his notes, because he was, but on the other hand, it's useful. I assume you had notes there because you were looking down and, yeah. Yeah, so what Jeff was doing was literalizing something that we all do. We've got a script and then we keep checking it. Like I notice when on these events or YouTube, whatever, there's such a realistic bunny there, Susie. I thought you actually had a dog for a second. It's not that it itself is realistic, but the way that you're relating to it. Because that's an autistic thing, actually, being able to connect objects. Yeah, I've noticed on the YouTube thing that I will look up a lot. Oh yeah, what was I going to say next, right? And it's actually distracting for me when I watch back. I think, well, why aren't I looking at people? I could look at the camera, that'd be more intense, but it's not as interesting for me. So why am I not looking at, well, on YouTube you can't, but even on the Zoom events, why am I not looking at the people when I'm talking? Well, because I'm referring to a script of some extent. I'm reaching for words. That's why improvisation is good, because if it flows fast enough, then you're not supposed to have time to think about what you're going to say, and just whatever comes up. But then that's a game, so it's not the same as people expressing themselves. I mean, it is obviously people expressing themselves, but they're not. Yes, Jeff.
Just, in my defense, I was improvising a lot. I just scribbled down a few ideas and then,
Yeah, no defenses. We don't accept defenses here. Only prosecutions. Well, it wasn't what you were saying, it was where your attention was. The fact that your attention kept going to the page, to me, it's sort of like Susie with, well, maybe it's not like Susie, but Susie with the rabbit, that could be seen as a comfort, as something that she uses to comfort herself. Maybe it's not, but that was what Jeff's notes looked like to me. It was like, as long as just keep checking, they're there, good, I've got my notes, I'm not going to come off... There you go. So this is one small step for mankind, one huge step for Jeffrey.
I'll defend myself now. If I may.
Well, no, you may not, but you can say something.
Okay. But, the rabbit and the moving and the whatever that I do now, it's kind of consciously done because I... was extreme habit of masking for so long that it only in the last 18 months or so that I became conscious to the degree of how much masking I was doing, and I had to kind of force myself to adopt more natural kind of mannerisms or autistic things that I had to kind of sort of bring them in and kind of do them obviously nearly on a bus, kind of force myself because the masking was so automatic that I had to fight against it. And so I'm more inhabiting that more now, and it feels more comfortable.
Yeah, thanks for expanding that, because I did something very similar actually. I didn't have a white rabbit, but when I first started identifying as autistic, I started doing some of the things I'd heard that autistics do. I would rock, I would hand wave, I would, and it really helped actually. But it was kind of symbolic. It was just like, I'm not going to try and hide the fact that I feel weird and uncomfortable now. I'll actually let my body express it. And it had this double purpose. One, it was comforting, but the other was, well, now I don't have to pretend so hard to be normal because the cat's out of the bag, not that it was ever in it. It's the irony. I mean, no one ever mistook me for normal. So I think it was also, there are also things that bring us more into the body, aren't they? Yes, Jed, you're smiling like a happy man.
Yeah, just thinking how whatever gimmicks we pull, it's very difficult to pass for normal if anyone pays close attention. I tried looking the part of whatever I imagined when I was younger, and then I couldn't bear it. It was so stifling. So I started behaving even though I would look like a fool, which allowed me then to, people basically stopped caring on the one hand. On the other hand, I realized that no one cared about me that much to really be offended by me misbehaving. It's not like I don't know my manners, but I kind of tried to behave as spontaneously as possible in all public gatherings. I'm not talking about, you know, a kid's birthday or a funeral. I'm talking about, you know, being on the bus, in the pub, in the park. And it slowly allowed me to posture and have gestures and express myself as I felt. And it's interestingly, I had greater extremes in behavior when I used to try and repress how I felt. And later when I let loose, I was much, much more normal than I assumed. I was quirkier when I tried to repress my emotions and how I felt. And the more I let loose, the more just average I became. There was very little to see, or less to see anyway. Yeah, also this stretching business, I hope everyone realizes it's not disrespectful in any way. I'm really enjoying it. I don't do this in work meetings.
Why would anyone think that was disrespectful?
No, because I was hiding some of my, I was like wiggling my arms, but under the laptop. So it didn't look like I wasn't listening.
That could have been misinterpreted.
Although you caught me there where I was, because I was laughing, but I wanted to say something which came to mind earlier, is for years I used to think in a way that I would read, I would consume information, I would reevaluate it, think some more, talk to people, debate about it, try and convince others, and so on. And then the more frequent these Zoom meetings have become, the less I'm able to do that. For example, every time I'm trying to prepare, and I thought, you know, if the topic of conversation this evening is going to be a last blog post, I should really, you know, have something to say. And it feels so inauthentic. Plus, I know I'm not going to be tested. It's not going to, like, you're going to ask me, so what's the third word in the fourth paragraph, which I capitalize, you know, it's not school. And yet, so when I came, I still felt in the back of my mind, I was like, really, you should have something to say about the very blog post. But as the conversation has continued, my sensations are getting stronger, and I'm just really appreciating everyone talking. Although I've taken the mic now, it's everyone talking has led me to places that I couldn't have gone to if I prepared for this Zoom meeting as if it was an exam, I could have never gone this, I would have never had the such a broad view of so many different things and, you know, ideas and people's experience. And this is, this has to be definitely one of the very few places where this happens to me, because everyone gets to talk. There's no time, there's no limitation to what someone can say. That's not necessarily true, but you guys, you get what I mean. Everyone's expressing themselves and I get to feel them. And today, for the first time, not specifically about because of what Susie said, before Susie spoke, I suddenly felt today that I could feel how vulnerable we all are. I had that very pronounced sensation after Jeff spoke. I don't think I've ever perceived vulnerability the way I perceived it this evening. There was a beauty to it. I think there's a lot to be said for having an opportunity to be in a liminal space in conversation with others. You get to experience something different to what your mind can conjure up. And I think it might have to do with us, with that knock on the prison wall you were referring to earlier. Maybe we're all responding in some way. So it's not just that we're feeding off each other's, the conversation and the content of what's being said. For me personally, it feels like it's something deeper. It's awakening something in myself. And there's so many things that come to mind to say, but there's no need to say them, because they evoke experiences. Probably a good place to stop as well.
Thanks for that, Jeremiah. Yeah.
Can I speak up?
You're waiting for permission.
Oh, I didn't know if you guys could hear me or not. You can hear me. that was just really a good example. Both hearing Susie and Chetamir, how the thing that I find attractive in other people is the quality of like vulnerability and doing something just maybe despite the discomfort. It's just funny how I will think that same thing would not be attractive in myself, or like want to hide that or appear like confident or like I have something important to say. It reminds me of like those 80s movies where like the cool guy is actually like the one that you don't like, and like the nerd is the one that everybody is actually rooting for. So it's like, why would it be so appealing to be the cool guy, or to want to control like how I come across and my perception? And I really like what Chetamir was saying about the less he tried to control it, the more normal he seemed, or something along those lines. But that rings true to me. It's almost like when I get up in my head and all self-conscious and trying, I feel like I'm trying to simulate what a human being should act like, or so I can like pass people or something like that. And it's along with the topic So that's another version of hell, you know. Just wanted to chime in on that.
Thanks, Jeff. I can second that. I mean, a number of things that Jeff said, including that I noticed the contrast, that contrast that Jeff mentioned, and how much I appreciate when people are fumbling and awkward and unsure of themselves, how much I tend to appreciate that quality in others, even though I try very hard to be the opposite. And because, you know, I'm in the, not unique, but fairly unusual position of getting to listen to myself and watch myself endlessly, I can notice it myself. It's like when I'm particularly confident or talking particularly perhaps eloquently in a certain kind of eloquence, I find it uncomfortable, and oh God, I wish I'd shut up. Occurred to me, I mean, Jeff, you almost said this, that another definition of hell might just be having to pretend to be something that we're not, and heaven would simply be being who we are, being what we are. It is a weird thing, you know, that we've got this unwritten contract to go along with a whole set of social norms that at a conscious level we don't really believe in. But I think there's something about that being cool, as in not being vulnerable, there's more to it than just trying to create the right impression, isn't there? It's actually trying to signal people to stay away, to keep a distance. Don't get too close, because I don't want to be hurt. We don't want to be hurt again. Which is a bit of a cliche, actually, the cool guy. You know, he's wounded on the inside. He's just learned to be tough. That's a survival thing.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think I was thinking about this as everyone was talking, that I felt really good, particularly, I think since the last day of the Easter thing, I felt consistently very good. The mind was thinking earlier about how, and having had psychosis, I really have experienced a demonic, evil personification or manifestation of hell. So while I can feel what you're talking about, there's a part of me that goes, yeah, but hell, you know, is there a place where souls go where it's even bloody worse than this? Because like psychotically I've seen that, those kinds of realms. I don't know, that could just be my psyche, the sort of dark fragment looking back at me and appearing. So the release from hell, is that the same as entering heaven?
I can't remember if it made it into Vice of Kings or not, but I think it didn't. But it was a dream I had. It was after Garbanzo had died. And he... Well, I dreamt that he was on the bed and he was communicating with me, and he communicated that he'd taken on a cat form again to comfort me, but he was chiding me. He was gently making fun of me, that my attachment to him in that way, that particular kind of attachment, the memory of him as a cat. I'm getting quite emotional now. Because I wasn't able to let go of that, I'd brought him back into his, the previous form that he'd left behind now. And then I guess it was the follow-on dream or something. Anyway, I saw hell in some way. I don't remember now how intense it was emotionally, because I've had a number of dreams about hell. In this case, I saw hell, or it got to, I somehow understood that hell was the accumulation of all the terrible things that humans had done to each other, kind of trapped in amber. You know, they say that houses have memory in the bricks and wood and whatever, or physical matter stores memory. Well, this was like memory, a memory in the ether or something. And I don't know, this is going to be a bit heavy, but I guess you know what you get with me. You at least know what you might get. That it entailed hell, going to hell, and it was something I knew I had to do, entailed reliving every single one of those memories of what human beings had done to each other, as if it was happening to oneself or as if one was inflicting it, depending. And, that was going to take a very long time, needless to say. Fortunately, it wasn't eternal, but still, good God. And I understood as well, I mean, through the process of beginning that process, whatever, the hell I was getting into at that point, poor old Jesus, that the reason hell had come about was because of the human desire to cling to good memories, and that over the eons we had tried to hold on to all our good memories of the things that had happened and preserve them and keep them for ourselves. And of course the side effect of that was we'd rejected all the horrible things. We don't want to remember those, don't want to think about those, so they got cast off. We create this pseudo heaven of these nice memories, and the inevitable result was that a hell had created itself, because all of these clusters of memories, or these individual memories, had clustered together, and then the clusters had clustered together until it created this spatial temporal matrix, body realm, whatever it was. So, I mean, the solution seemed kind of simple in a way, obviously. On the one hand, it was hellish, literally, like, I've got to now relive all these memories that humanity has collectively disowned so that they can be reintegrated into the human experience. It's a bit like going back into the trauma, isn't it? Letting the trauma release from the body by reliving the affect memory of it. On the one hand, there was that, which just seemed overwhelmingly terrible, insurmountable almost. But on the other hand, there was something more simple and instant, which is, well, just let go of the need to hold on to good memories and good experiences. What Jeff said, yeah, just being okay, surrendering. Jeff said something like, hell is surrender, heaven is surrender. I mean, you didn't use the word surrender, but understood as from what you were describing there. No preference, is what Jeff said. Having no preference, good or evil, just part of the human experience. And it seems that we can do that at a micro level all of the time with our conscious choices about whether to be vulnerable or not, which really is essentially letting go, surrendering. And vulnerability is surrender, surrendering of preference, rather than I want to be treated well here, I want to be liked, I want to be respected, I want to feel good, I want to be supported, I want positive human interactions, or, you know, whatever. There's an endless way in which we're micromanaging and we're making these choices that are supposedly ensuring for us a good feeling. But actually the only way we can maintain that good feeling is by shutting down, by not letting ourselves be vulnerable to things that would cause us bad feelings. So in the end, the quest for the good feeling, the pursuit of happiness, ill-advised by our overlords, guarantees misery.
Just where you were going with that was like a perfect metaphor for addiction. The idea of wanting to just retain the good memories is like trying to achieve this feeling through doing the same act over and over, but like it never works, or it only works like 1% of the time, but you spend 100% of the time chasing that 1% of the time when, you know, trying to get that good feeling. And in order to do that, you have to block out all the other hideous actions and, you know, horrible feelings and physical sensations and, you know, mental hell, in order to keep chasing that little slice of perceived relief or whatever. So it could be that addiction would be the metaphor for hell, like the lived, you know, or a lived metaphor for hell, or that what you were saying could be, I mean, could go either way, you know, what you were saying could be the metaphor. Either way, I think that model kind of fits in there nicely, and you know, not only necessarily with drug or alcohol addiction, but there's just so many. I mean, literally, could be addicted to anything, you know. So I just wanted to throw that in there. It was making me think about that.
That did fit nicely in, because yeah, that was the bit that I'd forgotten, which I wanted to finish on, was these choices that we make to not be vulnerable, which are synonymous with to try and feel good or avoid bad feeling, really. This is to say about addicts, right? They start because it makes them feel good, but in the end they're just doing the drugs so they don't feel bad. this is how we use our life force. We're choosing how we use our life force, what we use it for, and what we do to it. And it varies, but you know, Dave's been talking about this, like with the micro example, the thin end of the wedge that Jeff's talking about is just comfort food. He says junk food. I'd say even comfort food. Even it doesn't necessarily have to be junky, but we eat something just because we want the comfort. And then of course there's sex as well, which can be very benign, obviously. But how we use sex, porn, obviously, is not so benign, but probably more common as a compulsive go-to to feel good or not to feel bad. That these micro choices. They're all forms of addiction, and there's this overriding addiction was the addiction to, I suppose you could say, having control over our feelings would be one way of putting it. So I mean, the picture's emerging here, which is what my next blog post is supposed to be about, which is all the little choices we make, very much determined by our capacity to be vulnerable and to allow our life force to become conscious. And at the same time, they also determine that, as in, you know, what we do with the life force that we do have determines, you know, how much less or more life force we have following those actions. And so, yeah, obviously an addict is an extreme case, somebody who's doing heroin or even just an alcoholic, their life force is dwindling away in this endless desperate quest for good feelings, which is really a desperate attempt to get out of bad feelings that are in the body. But that, I mean, that's written very large, so it's easy for us to look at somebody like that or ourselves if we were that in the past and say, whoa, you know, that is a way to create a hell for ourselves. But it really is, it's a very wide spectrum. And I think this also pertains to, what is our purpose? Are we living our purpose? Or are we living in such a way that our purpose is becoming more experiential to us, more available to us? And that in turn has to do with how much we're able to show up for others and connect to others with our life force to bring all of ourselves, no matter how vulnerable or heartbreaking it might be. And then that in turn has to do with this thing we call heaven, this collective shared experience of heaven, as opposed to this isolate hell, which Mario was talking about. I think I don't know if I can analyze it, but it seems as though hell is something like just being trapped with all of the hungry ghosts that one has created in one's life. And it might very much seem like a vast bardo realm of demons and all the rest of it. Especially if you throw the ancestors in there as well. So it's kind of like Jeff was saying, hell is other people's opinions. They'd kind of be your own opinions, actually, and your ancestors. But maybe also the things that you'd done that had affected others and so on and so forth. But it's a very crowded place, and yet lonely is the crowd. One is all alone in that crowd because there's no sentience there. There's just these programs of despair. So I think it's like an addict's life, isn't it? Being trapped by the programs of despair. I just kind of wanted to address Mari's sadness as an example or something. I'm not sure what exactly, but does seem to be a correlation for me anyway with being vulnerable and being able to grieve, being able to express sorrow. But there's also what Mari pointed out, which is it can become a performance. I mean, I didn't feel it was a performance with Mari. I'm sure no one else did either. But I think what Mari's pointing out is everything can become a performance. We know how to turn everything into a way not to be seen, including vulnerability. We can simulate and counterfeit vulnerability, because vulnerability isn't crying in public per se. I mean, look at the Jerry Springer show. Those people are not being vulnerable. So yes, vulnerability is certainly much more subtle and spontaneous and mysterious than that. It's really being able to be fully spontaneous, so that what shows up of our life force, we don't know. We didn't even know it was there until it shows up. And we let go of the reins as far as what might happen next. But I do think that there's a massive amount of effort for many of us, and possibly all of us, if we think about the state that humanity's in, a massive amount of effort goes to pushing down the sadness, the grief of being human. There's such an enormous backlog. And if you think about that hell that I dreamt up, let's hope it was just a dream. I don't think it was, personally, but... what I wasn't factoring in my description was the sorrow of that. I mean, the terror was what I felt in the dream, the agony and the terror of hell. That's the Christian picture of hell, really, is agony and terror. But what about the sorrow? What about the endless sorrow, seemingly endless, of all of those souls, those lives that have ended up there, trapped in, ever... repeating loops of rage and hatred and despair. There was a third one. I was listening to a tape of myself yesterday, and I said my main enemies were, it wasn't hatred, it was rage, despair, what was it? It ended up fad. Fear was the other one, of course, fear. Fear, anger and despair, fad. I think we do anything we can, many of us, to push down the sorrow, and so we could say ancestral sorrow, but it's also our personal sorrow of this life, and not to grieve and not to feel the remorse. There are many things we do, but that's kind of the... The condition of our keeping that sorrow out is that we can't be vulnerable even with ourselves, even when we're alone. We can't actually let ourselves feel the condition that we're in. Which is back to why I really appreciate people who seem to be quite obviously a bit dysfunctional. Because I think, oh my God, at least they're waking up enough to see that the mask isn't who they are. That the socialized ways of being are just the equivalent of prisoners who've learned the protocol, learned to walk in file and say yes sir, no sir, including the persecution of other prisoners and the jockey status jockeying and the power grabs and all the rest of it, the things that create kind of hell on earth. So yeah, I think the expressing sadness is a bit like singing. It's very hard to do and maintain control. But then of course there are those who learn to sing and then they become professional singers. There are professional criers. I know one or two. but that wasn't what Mario was expressing. That was something I'm sure that we're all feeling, or were able to feel at the time. Now, if Chad were to break down and cry, then we would know that we'd made some headway. If I was, for that matter. I can cry in groups, but maybe not when I'm leading them.
Just to come back and say that my experience of hell is very much like your dream. That we had to re-experience all of the things we'd done.
Again, I wouldn't want us to try and approach it too intellectually or too literally, but what do you feel that your purpose is, or how do you feel a sense of purpose, or where do you feel purpose, or how do you experience having purpose or not having purpose? How important is it to you to have a sense of purpose? Are you looking for a purpose? Because I mean, I'm in a funny position, more ways than one, but around this particularly, is that could say that part of my purpose is to help people to find their purpose. But that's a bit circular somehow. Or is it? Because then that brings in the possibility that we have a shared purpose. And essentially, we all have the same purpose. I said on the recent event that Dave was asking us to say, or it was an AG about our purpose, I said, well, for me, well, one angle that I could approach this question was that I have a sense of two purposes. One that's more about a function, and that's quite finite, and that for me had to do with exposing secrets, uncovering secrets, and or mapping hell. And then there's another purpose, which, and that purpose has an end, and I feel that certain sense maybe I'm reaching the end of it, even though I know there are many more secrets, especially my own. I haven't uncovered my own secrets yet, but I know that's not something I could consciously do anyway. The secret protects itself and all that. And then there's this other purpose, which was could only really begin once I'd completed that first purpose, which is more worldly, more of a worldly purpose. And then there's another worldly purpose. But I also know that the times that I most feel like I'm doing my purpose, I'm in touch with my purpose, is when I'm interacting with others, and there's a flow, and there's a connectivity, and there's something is moving that needs to move, and I'm doing my bit to allow that thing to move, and that feels very purposeful. Anyway, so that's my bit on how I experience purpose.
When I hear the word purpose in relation to like me having one, I get a block because it's such a to me, the word implies like a destination, you know, and I just can't know that. But I can associate purpose with usefulness, and then it kind of ties in to more of a, whatever you want to say, like the journey rather than the destination, or like thinking, it's easier for me to think, how can I be useful than what's my purpose? And so it's almost like if I can bide my time, just trying to be useful somehow is to, in the meantime, before I know my purpose, then maybe it will reveal itself, or maybe they're one and the same. And sometimes I don't even know the best way I can be useful, but I feel like at least that's one less degree of separation, where like I can rely on my intuition to tell me in any given situation, like what's my best course of action to like the course of least resistance for the situation that I'm involved in. And sometimes I feel like that's the best I can do. When I try and think of my purpose, it's really hard for me not to involve, I guess, my ego, you know, because of my I will tend to think of my purpose as being somewhat grand, or grandiose.
So when you think of your purpose as grandiose with your mind, how do you relate to that vision? Is it something you feel that you're engaged in, or is it something you feel that you haven't yet got to?
It starts to seem unattainable. Because there's too much ground to cover. So then I tend to throw my hands up, and it makes it more difficult to move forward when I think of my purpose as being something that, and it also has a relation to it as there's some expectation there, and that also kind of shuts me down. Like if I have a purpose, then if I don't meet it, then I've failed. So I'd rather just accept the failure now, you know. Those are just some of the, that's just kind of where my mind goes to. Like I said, it's like a block. I get a block when I start thinking of like trying to think of what my purpose is. And I don't know if that's maybe me like a misinterpreting the concept somehow.
Yeah. Well, let's see what others have to say. Chedimir just moved into my full screen. Was that because you were about to say something?
Yeah, I was. Sorry if I jumped the gun, but I want to say, Jeff, I felt like you spoke in my name, almost word for word. That's essentially how I feel. I like being useful. I like helping other people. It allows my intuition to kick in. Sometimes it's just reflex, the way I was brought up, but usually allows me to decide case by case. It gives me meaning and some purpose. But as soon as I think of the purpose, completely blank. I have one pet project I've been mulling around thinking about for the past 10 years, which sounds grandiose, or I think appears grandiose, but it isn't. Or it might be, but anyway, it's something I haven't even really started. I have a domain name and like three articles up with the aim of setting up small cooperatives. Yeah, but it feels almost like I'm hiding behind my usefulness in order to prevent to stop myself from having to come to that, listen to myself and even entertain the idea that I have a bigger purpose. The purpose. I got a 9-pound.
Thought did cross my mind when Jeff was using the word useful. I mean, I like to be useful too in the thrift store and so on, but I see that my purpose isn't being useful so much as that being useful helps me to tune into my purpose, if you can understand what I mean by that. As in, if my purpose is not of this world, let's say, and has to do with connecting to people in very difficult circumstances and drawing out things in them that otherwise would not be brought forth, and the thrift stores and being useful undercover, as it were, of being useful is a way for that to happen. But on the other hand, of course, as I've said in my chat with Chedomir recently about the drunks, there's a danger that one can just enable behaviours by giving people what they want or being useful to them. There can be a complicity with that. And the image did come to mind when Ched was speaking of again, the prison inmates who, you know, they go along to get along. They want to, if you're in prison, you want to make sure that you've got a function and that you're useful to the other inmates and even the guards, otherwise you might end up shanked in the shower or worse, right? So there's I would say there's definitely that risk that we will find ways, and that socialization in a nutshell, isn't it? What's your use, right? How can you make yourself useful? That's built into the configuration of society, is that everyone has to be a contributing member in order to justify their existence. So, I mean, earlier when somebody was speaking, and we were talking generally about not pretending and being who we are, I wanted to ask people, well, what do you think you are? What would you be? What will you be when all the pretending is over? And what kind of useful will that be? Of what use will that be for you to really be what you are? probably not so social. It probably wouldn't be so easy to evaluate that in terms of social usefulness, like Thomas Anderson, who helps his old neighbor with the garbage kind of thing. You know, what are our various little signals of virtue that make up our cover story? That's very different from actually what our higher purpose is. I presume it is. Now, it doesn't mean they can't converge. I mean, presumably they would converge. They do need to converge. I don't know what kind of exemplary I am, because I, you know, in certain ways, I've obviously been living a big purpose and doing all kinds of things that could impress all kinds of people. Well, not very many, but the people whose attention I get with, well, there's somebody who's living his purpose. But on the other hand, I went to all extreme, the extremes that you know about, probably shouldn't even mention the names, but as Jeff was talking about, I mean, so grandiose it's probably too bad I didn't get paralyzed by fear, actually, that I actually tried to enact that scenario. I don't know. I mean, I might have done more harm than good, possibly. So it's clear that living one's purpose isn't about being grandiose or doing big dramatic things or having a website or a podcast. You know, these are just different cover stories, really. But then, of course, you have cover stories that are perhaps closer to our real essence and further from it. Like, we'll always have some cover. Susie's talking about the mask. You can't actually not have a mask. Even Dave's got a persona, because we wouldn't be able to interact. People would run screaming from the room if we just showed up with no mask. They wouldn't even be able to identify what it was, right? So there's some sort of cover is required. Well, I could say more, but I actually would like to hear from Susie about what she's feeling there. Mari, you kind of said something already, but yeah.
Okay. The purpose question. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Am I talking? Yeah.
Yeah.
The purpose question was a massive sense of a cause of torment for me. And it kind of persecuted me so much for the first few years when I quit my job 10 years ago in a kind of a regular corporate job. And I kind of thought I'd leave and I'd be, you know, an artist or a stylist or, you know, had a sort of a plan, but it wasn't going to happen. And I tried for a while, but it was like something was stopping me. The more I went towards what I thought I was going to do, something was pushing me back. It was very intense. And then I thought, well, maybe I should just have a regular purpose. And I kept having this kind of alter voice saying, just be a teaching assistant, just do the course and get it. And I would kind of go to the school and nearly sign up for it. But I just knew, no, that's not either. And then it kind of gradually started to become clear to me that I had to let go of the idea completely of having anyone. And just relax. It was terrifying, though. It caused me so much anguish, like literally years of waking up in the night. And I describe it as, I mean, there was a lot of other stuff going on, processing an awful lot of repressed trauma. But this was a singular kind of major at the forefront terror of what are you going to do with your life and what are you going to be? And I would like literally wake up in the middle of the night, nearly chewing the table, trying to hold on to something in that. But even in the strength of it and the force of it, sort of began to come clear. And then it eventually became even more clear when I really tried to do something and it was like, bam, no, you're not doing it. you're not doing it. When I started to not do anything and let go of it, and you're not going to be a writer, you're not going to be a fashion stylist, you're not going to have a YouTube page, you're not going to sell vintage clothes. I nearly started to like deliberately again start shutting them down, nearly putting away, wanting to fold those parts of myself, kind of shut them out. But it was really hard as well, because I was living in London and everybody was doing their thing, and what are you doing, and people only seemed to like me because, or thought I was good, you know, the only thing that interested them was, oh, the vintage clothes, and when are you doing that again? So I had to kind of, but I had to kind of let go of a lot of people. But I sort of realized that the whole idea of it was to be totally, I guess, and when I heard the word liminal, it seems to describe my whole existence.
That was one of the things I said on the Dave thing was, well, part of my purpose, or one way of looking at my purpose, is I'm trying to live without a purpose. And I think there is more than a wordplay in that. And it's actually back to the analogy I used at the beginning about music or sex, was the cup has to be empty before it can be filled. Like, to the extent that, you know, I've been very productive in my life, as people know. I've written books and films and all, you know, you name it. I've been busy most of my life. But I was certainly aware through most of that, maybe, or certainly in my 30s anyway, I became acutely aware that this was quite compulsive, and I started to think, what if I just stopped doing any of this? You know, would I go mad and go postal and shoot up the neighborhood, or would I implode? And it felt like I actually couldn't stop doing it, and that made me want to try. And I did try to give up writing a few times and never succeeded. So I can definitely relate to what Susie's saying now. I never did what she did. And I do feel that I'm at a place now where my productivity isn't primarily compulsive. That's more of a response to a need. And, you know, that was probably a big part of why I wanted to be successful, was so I could justify my overachieving kind of thing, was as in, well, there's a demand now, I've got to write another book because the last one was a bestseller, sort of thing. I'm doing interviews, and you know, I had that fantasy that people have of being famous, where you get the whole world to enable your displacement activities, the ways in which you stay out of the horror and the sadness and the despair of doing nothing in a room kind of thing, just keeping still.
I'm very intrigued by this this concept of purpose, and I'm especially curious how Dave means it or interprets it, if it's posed as a question that's meant to have an answer, or if it's just something that's meant to be contemplated or considered, or you know, that's supposed to open up some other channel of thought. Mm-hmm. And is it possible to fulfill one's purpose without ever being aware of or identifying what the purpose is? Or do you like necessarily need to have the purpose as a goal in order to meet, you know what I mean? Is it my purpose, or is it something outside of me? That just those kind of questions come up for me. So I'm wondering if you can shed some light on what you think he means by it.
Put you out of your misery. You said shed some light, and I was going to ask Ched, if he could shed some light on it, because he was also at the Dave event, both of them, Saturday and Sunday, in which we got a browbeating from our drill sergeant. Ted, did you have any? Do you have anything you remember that would help Jeff out here? Or he's shaking his head now. He's shirking. So this is a word that Dave brought up. shirking from duty. Not consciously, I'm sure. I don't think Ted's withholding, but... and I don't want to put too much heat on Ted. I did mention that I have a feeling what Dave's talking about with Chedomir, and it has to do with the Chedomir seems to me more obviously more than he's pretending to be. You get plenty of people who are, you could see that they're struggling and that they're, you know, not really getting it and so on, and so you just think, well, I'll give them some time, don't want to, and they're not going to respond well to pressure. Whereas with Chedomir, it seems as though, or maybe it's partly to do with his physical attributes, but there's something quite formidable about Chedomir. I mean, of course, his Serbian background, I mean, his history, but also his intellect, and there's many, many things about Chedomir that make him more formidable than he's letting on. Now, is it humility, or is it, what's the other thing that would be? Shirking, really, like, no, not me, who, me? Me? I'm not a Serbian warrior who can chop off your enemy's heads for you. No, sir. No, I'll just wash the toilet here with this toothbrush. That's the sense I get with Jeremy. Like, he's not really fooling me when he's like, oh, I don't know, because something else is coming through. Anyway, that was really just a side thing. Unless Ted wants to respond to it, he can. Doesn't have to. So Jeff's thing about purpose, I was hoping Ted might remember or volunteer was that Dave, by the end of it all, he said, well, that he doesn't know what his purpose is, because it depends on every moment in which, and it depends on who he's interacting with, that whatever is coming out is his response to that situation, and then he knows his purpose, so it's just constantly, right? I felt that, well, that was true, and I could have said something similar if I thought of it in time, but I also felt it was not true in that Dave could also say, he could have also given a more defined purpose if he'd wanted, as he's here to help people find the purpose, he's here to help people become aware of who they are, he said this, he's here to bring out people's awareness of their pain, to draw out their love, and there's a number of different things Dave has said that he could, if he wanted to in that moment, he could have defined as his purpose, but he chose at the end of it all to say, well, no, in a certain sense, you don't know what your purpose is until you're doing it, and I think that's very essential. I even said about Dave today with my wife that sometimes he says and does things and he doesn't seem to be conscious of why he's doing them, and that seems to make him more effective. Like, if he was consciously doing something and basically seeing something, formulating a strategy and then following the strategy, he'd be less effective than he was if he's simply responding, doesn't even know why, but then later it all, right? Athletes are the same. You're a surfer, so you know, you don't get on your surfboard and start trying to calculate the size of the waves, and you just respond. So that's a very general thing, but it doesn't preclude, again, it doesn't preclude a sense knowing what your purpose is. It would certainly include feeling that you knew what your purpose was. The feeling is when you're surfing and you're doing it right, you know it, right? So that would be the thing that I would say is really key there, and that sometimes that can translate into language and thoughts and the rest of it. One can articulate, oh, this is my purpose now. Whereas if you really don't know what your purpose is, or if you're really feeling you need to say that, then you probably haven't found your purpose, right? Because it wouldn't be a question anyway. You might not need to defend it and say, yes, I found my purpose, but you'd be just like, the question's not really relevant. And here's why. maybe. However, on that last point, I think there's something about this idea of purpose that that Jeff was sort of articulating or embodying with the question, the non-question question, which is this, that it fills a space, like the idea of purpose, because you can't, yes, when you start thinking about purpose, you get this kind of thing, well, wait a minute, if I knew what my purpose was, then I wouldn't be doing it, and it can't just be something that I would just, and all these things that Jeff was saying. But on the other hand, if you just say, oh, purpose, it's irrelevant, then that allows for the saboteur to just say, well, like Jeff was saying earlier, well, I'll just be useful and I'll just make myself useful and just be a good inmate in the prison and I'll get along and maybe eventually sooner or later I'll figure out what I'm doing here, but really it's not for me to know anyway. You know, that can very easily become a get out clause for us. You know, it's like saying predetermined. It's like that argument, well, everything's predetermined, so I don't have to make choices. Wrong. You do have to make choices, even if you believe that they're predetermined, you still have to make them, right? So we're still choosing to embody life force or to act with purpose or not. And so this idea of purpose is itself, it's a bit like death or God, or maybe many words, but certainly big words, that they're there to draw our attention to something that we don't understand, so that we can start to feel our way into it. Right? I mean, purpose is something, I think we could say it's transcendental, unless, I mean, I made the point on the meet that there's function and there's purpose, and Jeff has made the point about being useful, and so one can certainly have a day that's filled with purpose in terms of being functioning and doing things that are useful, but to actually have a consistent sense of purpose in one's life, you know, from morning until night, which I can see that Dave has, I don't have it, but I do have it quite consistently, that would seem to require something that transcends the ordinary everyday.
That certainly rings true. And when I was talking about being useful, I wasn't necessarily thinking like in just practical utilitarian terms, like, you know, taking out the garbage or helping the old lady cross the street, but more in terms of how you were saying what you would imagine Dave to say about that, you know, like helping other people find their purpose. And I just had the thought that if that's at least part of enlightenment, then that would kind of be everybody's purpose, you know. Would be to help others find their purpose and, you know, grow, whatever sort of spiritual direction, you know.
Susie's back. You trailed off a bit there at the end, and Jeff, and of course the word spiritual can often be evidence that one is trailing off, and I don't mean that as a criticism, but as a you were evidencing, I think, that how difficult it becomes to articulate, partly because it can come out sentimental or like we've heard it all before and we didn't believe it the last time kind of thing. Also, because it can be a bit tautological, if everyone's purpose is to help each other find their purpose, well, what's the purpose once everybody's found their purpose, right? The danger in trying to fill that gap is if I were to say something like our purpose is to build heaven through loving interconnectivity or something like that, then well, you've just got a concept, don't you, right? And concepts aren't really, there's not much meat on the bones of concepts. So then we're back to this conundrum. Purpose seems to be more like a question than an answer. And yeah, I think that what you were saying, Jeff, is similar to what I would say about myself and certainly about Dave. Having a response. Is that your cat? Speaking of responses, you're needed, Jeff. Having a response it's that word, isn't it? Responsibility. Having the ability to respond to what one's fellow human souls need, starting with oneself and one's loved ones. And the point I made in my conversation with Chedimir is how, one of the points is how hard it can be for us to really be there fully responsible with our closest loved ones. Showing up with as much as of us as we have access to, and it's almost like it always has to be a bit more than we have access to, but of course that couldn't be pretending. But I said recently about on a blog post how one of my skills is to act as if I was fearless, even though I'm not. And of course that could turn into trying to be cool or something like that, as in pretending I'm not afraid. But what I meant by it was just to override that fear impulse that says don't do it, because this can be risky, because sometimes the fear is giving you good advice. But if it seems that it's not based in anything real, and it's more like social anxiety, just do it and see what happens. I think that's very close to the quick of this thing of showing up with more love than it feels safe to reveal or to share. To not withhold on the condition, to not withhold love with the condition that we want to see a guarantee that our love will be received and reciprocated before we share it, or vulnerability or sorrow or honesty, like we're in this endless poker game of having to, you know, keep the poker face, and you never know how it's going to turn out. You know, I might actually regret playing my hand at this point. Well, of course, that's none of that. Those kind of calculations are compatible with spontaneity or the ability to respond, which is always spontaneous. And love seems, to me, is the energy of that, is spontaneity, joy and love. They're all interrelated, I think. And that would seem to be our purpose, our shared purpose, is to show up with spontaneity, with love, with joy, and with a sense of responsibility, you know, openness to responding to whatever comes at us with all of us, and not flinching. There we go. Finally found a point to end on. We overcome the original flinch mechanism. As simple as that, you know, how not to flinch. However, I mean, this is, it can go round and round. I said it was a point to end on, but the reason we want to override the flinch mechanism is so we can really have a response. So it's like this first purpose is to overcome the trauma programming and let go and open and be vulnerable and show up. And then, you know, once we're fully here, which would be Dave's enlightenment, then the purpose begins. And then that purpose, of course, has no end. It has no beginning. Well, it would have a beginning point, I suppose, in a certain sense, because it would be a morning, a bright new morning when we woke up fully landed. Still hoping that I have time to have that morning. Morning wood came to mind, obviously not the correct expression here, but we're guys. I mean, three of us are guys, so we get to be guys. But yeah, being fully present and accounted for. Anyway, Susie, I realise you didn't get to finish. You got froze out by your own technology. You didn't hear my response, but it was very poignant what you said, and I did respond to it, so you can hear that on the replay. But because you weren't finished, if you want to pick up where you left off, that would also be fine.
I'm sorry. Yeah, my computer froze. I just say that the purpose, not having one, not looking for one, just became the purpose for a long time, and it seemed, and it worked, and it worked, and it worked more, so it allowed an awful lot to happen, and for me to move in the right direction. And I don't really question it. I question it sort of now, but in a different type of a way. It's more kind of blended in with my existence. It's not sort of separate. It's more just, I don't know, it didn't seem like such a big separate thing anymore. I think the purpose is just moving forward now. Continuing. But it was a very profoundly extreme issue, and it had a lot to do with identity for me. And not being in that place anymore. I look back on it, and I do go back to those nights and those years, and the extent of it was really quite intense. But it's nice to be looking back and to be here now.
Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, change with the times. Dangers in the dark, clouds up and downtown. Changes in your soul.